If you like Area 45, you're going to enjoy the Hoover Institution's other podcasts, Uncommon Knowledge, The Classicist with Victor Davis Hanson, and The Libertarian with Richard Epstein. Subscribe now to the Hoover Podcast at hoover.org/podcasts. That's hoover.org/podcasts. Hoover Podcast, ideas defining a free society. Hello, it's Wednesday, October the 30th, and you're listening to Area 45, a Hoover Institution podcast examining the policy avenues available to the 45th President of the United States. I'm Bill Whalen, the Hoover Institution's Virginia Hobbs Carpenter Fellow. Joining me in studio today in our recording studio here on the campus of Stanford University is Dr. Lonnie Chen. Lonnie Chen is the Hoover Institution's David and Diane Steffi Research Fellow in American Public Policy Studies. He's also the Director of Domestic Policy Studies and lecturer in Stanford's Public Policy Program. Lonnie Chen is a regular on Sunday morning talk circuit, shows which have four-letter words like meat and face. His byline appears often on the nation's leading print opinion pages. In 2012, Lonnie Chen was policy director for Mitt Romney's presidential campaign. In 2016, he pitched in for the presidential effort of Florida Senator Marco Rubio. Lonnie, it's great to have you back on the podcast.
Thanks, Bill.
Forget about April being the cruelest month for you, my friend. It is October and a little thing called the Los Angeles Dodgers. Have you already transitioned to LeBron, or is your heart still bleeding blue?
I took a while to mourn the Dodgers, but I am excited about LeBron. I'm excited about the Lakers, and we'll see. So far, so good. Good start.
Actually, a serious question. Since you're a Southern California native, is your family safe down south?
They are, yeah. I have some family, my wife's family, on the west side of L.A., relatively close to the fire, actually, the Getty fire, but they're okay. And
they're in Brentwood or
and,
Palisades.
They're in Encino. And then my folks are well east, so fortunately they're fine, but so many have been affected down there and up here in the Bay Area as well.
Yeah. Let's talk about Republicans, Lonnie. Let's start with one in particular, your old boss, Mitt Romney. Something about Romney that occurred to me the other day is how his political career has come full circle in some regards. Before 2012 and 28, when he ran for the presidency, before he was governor of Massachusetts, he runs for the Senate against Ted Kennedy, 1994. He's now in the Senate, albeit representing a different state than Massachusetts, but he's now a senator, something he tried to be 25 years ago. In 2008, he runs against John McCain. John McCain gets a nomination, Romney doesn't, but Romney's now in the Senate, and some people would say he's now John McCain, the Republican senator with the national standing, the national following, and the guts to stand up to an incumbent president. You see it the same way?
Well, yeah. I mean, obviously, Mitt Romney's done a lot in his career. I think he's definitely traversed a lot of territory. And being someone who's been involved in politics for so long as he has, right, who has held all these different positions, I do think people look to him for thought leadership. But I do think also he is aware of his place in the Senate. He's aware of his place in history now. So that's a really interesting way of thinking about his career, though. I sort of hadn't thought about all those different parallels. But the thing I consistently say about Mitt Romney is you cannot put him into a single box. You know, people are always saying, is he the next McCain? Is he the next this? Yeah. Mitt Romney is Mitt Romney, and he's going to do and say and act in a way that will leave him with a clear conscience.
Okay, so one thing which is kind of unique about the Hoover Institution, Lonnie, is we have certain fellows here who I'd call whisperers. If you want to talk about Ronald Reagan, you go to George Shultz because he knew the man very well. He knew Nancy Reagan very well. He's our Reagan whisperer. If you want to talk about George W. Bush, you go to Condoleezza Rice because she knew George W. Bush very well, Secretary of State, NSC advisor. She's a Bush whisperer. You're our Romney whisperer here at Hoover. Congratulations. So let me ask you the question you've probably gotten 1,000 times since he made the comments the other day about Trump. What is Mitt Romney thinking exactly? And people want to be conspiratorial about these things. Is there any kind of end game? Does he want to be the leader of some kind of Senate hashtag resistance? Does he want to challenge Trump in primaries? Why is Senator Romney doing this?
Yeah, I can assure you there's no grander scale plan here. This is really Mitt Romney at a point in his life and career where he feels really comfortable saying what's on his mind. Now, that having been said, he is also fully aware that as a member of the U.S. Senate, he's going to be a juror in a potential impeachment proceeding trial that would come before the Senate.
And he said he's open-minded.
He's open-minded. He said that in an interview this morning. He's not going to prejudge the process one way or the other, which means he's going to look at the available evidence and make a decision, which I think is a great position to be in, you know, to be someone who truly feels free to follow the facts where they lead. And that's where he is. I think anybody who tries to ascribe more motivation to him, you know, that somehow this is part of some plan to do X, Y, or Z, just they're just, you know, off base. That's not what's going on here.
Describe, characterize to me the Trump-Romney relationship. I find it to be exceptionally complicated. Romney gives a very critical speech about Donald Trump and character in the 2016 election. After the election, he sits down with Donald Trump and they talk about being in the State Department. The senator has said that he believes that they're friends. The president called him the other day, I think, a pompous ass was the phrase that he used on mm-hmm. Twitter. Mm-hmm. I don't know if it's a love-hate relationship, but this is complicated.
Well, it is. I mean, you know, anytime you have people who have both been as successful as Donald Trump and Mitt Romney have important roles and responsibilities, you're going to have, you know, areas where you disagree. I think that, look, for Romney, he is going to be somebody who believes very strongly that the way you act privately should be the way you are publicly, and that you should comport yourself in a way that, you know, where no one else has to question what your motives are, what you're doing. And, you know, in that sense, I think sometimes personality-wise, maybe him and Trump have differences. I think that Romney is more than happy to be supportive of President Trump where there are areas of agreement. There have been lots of them during the president's term in office, whether it's judges or tax policy or getting tough on China. Those are areas where they agree, and he will be supportive. He's not somebody – Mitt Romney is not somebody who just sort of pokes at someone to poke at them. That's just not the nature of the guy. So it is a complicated relationship because on the one hand, you have these personality differences. Mm-hmm. The two men have led their lives, I think, in very different ways privately. And so, you know, you're going to have those differences. But from a policy perspective, there's a lot of areas where they agree. And Mitt's not afraid to say that they do agree in many ways. And he's happy to help the president where their interests align.
The anonymous, the pseudonym, pseudonymous Twitter account.
Yeah.
What's the deal?
I think it was it's been pretty extensively reported, and I think he's been pretty open about it. You know, started as a way for him to follow various folks on Twitter to see what was going on, and eventually, you know, Pierre jumped in there and said some things. And I think it's endearing how Mitt's embraced it all, and I think it's fabulous. Look, I think the way that he has reacted to it, you know, there's been people on Twitter get all fired up about this kind of stuff, and sure. It's like, you know. It was kind of a fun way for him to see what was going on and occasionally communicate about it. But I think the funnest part of the whole story is the name. You know, really, the Pierre Delecto thing is just so it's just so so funny to me. But that account will be no more.
Yes.
Now.
What's your over-under and how many of the 535 members of Congress have something like that going on right now?
Oh, I think a lot of them do. I mean, I think they, you know, people always want to know what's going on. Free from the filtering of staff and people who handle these guys all day long, you know, they just want to know what's happening. So, you know, the interesting question will be, what would be the secret names that all these different people would adopt? You know, that would be a fun column, actually. Someone should write that, if someone hasn't already. The secret names of the...
That would be, do you go by your favorite author? Do you...
Correct.
Do you come up with the porn name? How correctly do you do
well, it? Well, or, you know, there's a story about how when people on, you know, candidates on campaigns stay at hotels, they never use their real names.
Exactly.
They always use some pseudonym. So maybe that's what it is.
I like it. When was the last time you were in Washington?
Yesterday.
Yesterday.
Yeah, I just got back late last night, actually, from Washington.
Okay.
Yeah.
Let's talk about the mood of the town. I got back in the country on Monday afternoon, Lonnie. On Tuesday morning, I walked up, and I don't know how you go about getting your news. I'd be curious, by the way, as to how you start your day information-wise. But I do a sweep, and I usually go to the Drudge Report just to see what's being promoted, what's kind of, you know, what where it's a siren and what's not. And I was greeted with this screaming headline, quote, "Republicans fear 2020 wipeout." And what Drudge was linking to, Lonnie, was a column at Axios by Mike Allen, formerly Politico, founder now of Axios, is a very DC publication. And Allen was talking about a bad scenario for Republicans. He took in particular Greg Walden, the only Republican member from Oregon. He's stepping down. He's been in Congress for 20 years, so we don't know if he's retiring because he's just fed up with the place or he fears losing a seat. He then talked about Republicans in danger of losing the Senate, and then he segued into Trump trailing in national polls and swing states. He painted a pretty grim picture, in short, for the GOP.
Yeah, I mean, look, the House is going to be tough. we saw in 2018 what that looked like. I don't think people feel, well, most people you talk to in Republican circles are pretty pessimistic about the House in 2020. Right. The presidency will be what it is. It's going to be a heavily contested contest. The Senate is where the rubber hits the road in my mind. And for Republicans, there are a number of races that are going to be very, very tough. And, you know, we've got good incumbents. We, meaning Republicans, have good incumbents in a number of those races. I would say, you know, if you look at Cory Gardner in Colorado, there's no other Republican that's competitive in Colorado aside from Cory. And, right. And he's the ideal guy to try and hold that seat. Susan Collins in Maine. You look at Martha McSally in Arizona, Tom Tillis in North Carolina. I think those are the first couple up that most people talk about. But the Senate's going to be tough. I do think that Republicans are concerned about how a lot of what's in the environment right now will affect the election next year, namely the impeachment discussion. Candidates for the Congress are not going to be able to avoid the questions about impeachment. They're not going to be able to avoid questions about President Trump. And you know, I think President Trump would love for everybody to embrace him, but that's just not the reality of Cory Gardner's life in Colorado. Or if you're running in a seat in California, for example, Katie Hill resigned recently, representing a seat in northern L.A. County. If a Republican wants to take that seat, they're going to have to campaign in a very different way than somebody running in a safe Trump district. So there's got to be a recognition of that, and I think that because some of that nuance is lost sometimes on the president, Republicans are concerned about what might happen.
If you weren't here the other day, Lonnie, you missed some bad air days here in Northern California,
yeah.
Just smoke in the air. I imagine impeachment's the same way in Washington. It's just a smoky fog that hangs over the town right now. Mitt Romney being a good example, I did a data dive on Senator this morning, and about six impeachment stories come up, and then the seventh one down there, Mitt Romney has a plan for Social Security.
Yeah, introduced a big plan yesterday, actually.
Well, that's kind of important, but it gets buried by impeachment.
Yeah, no, it is. It's remarkable. You know, Nancy Pelosi has said that she thinks Democrats can walk and chew gum at the same time. In other words, they can do impeachment and do substantive business on issues that I'd argue Americans care more about. It's very difficult because all the oxygen in the room is taken up by impeachment. I mean, if you turn on most cable news channels, it's wall to wall still on, you know, here's who testified today behind closed doors. Here's the latest on impeachment. Here's the latest leak from the White House about impeachment. It's tough. It's more than just a cloud that hangs over the town. It gets into all the nooks and crannies, and I really think it does dominate a lot of what's happening there.
You
right
know,
now.
I thought that was Katie Hill's line of defense, Lonnie. She said, "You want members who can multitask? I'm multitasking. Yeah. I'm representing you, and I have quite a social life going on."
Yeah. Yeah, boy. Yeah, it's quite a story, that's for sure.
It is. Well, God bless California. We do deliver at times.
Yeah.
I think one thing, Lonnie, that people don't understand about American politics is that campaign cycles are kind of like hourglasses or egg timers, if you will, that an election occurs, and the moment after the election is over, you flip the egg timer and the sand starts running out again.
Yeah.
And that's going to happen, sure enough, the day after the 2020 election.
Yeah.
And for Republicans, this is especially interesting because regardless of the outcome, it's an open election for Republicans, unless you want to paint me a scenario in which Donald Trump is defeated and runs again in 2024. Otherwise, though, you're looking in an open seat. Let's talk about this for a moment. This is the way, way too early 2024 podcast, but here's what I'm interested in. What exactly this Republican field is going to look like in 2024? Because I look back at the 2016 election, Lonnie, and I see something unique. I see both parties kind of emerging, not really sure who they are exactly.
Mm-hmm.
And I think some of this is playing out right now in front of us in terms of these panicky Republican stories, but also the piece I'm sure you saw by Jonathan Martin in the New York Times the other day just saying a bunch of Democratic swells are sitting around thinking, holy smokes, we got to find somebody better to run for office. Both parties, I think, are scrambling for something new, something different, something better, if you will. So I'm going to throw a bunch of names at you right now, Lonnie,
sure.
And let's go through the crowd. So if Trump is reelected, then you have to start Mike Pence. He's sitting vice president.
Yeah.
So he has national standing.
Yeah, he has national standing. He's got a lot of Republicans think very highly of him. He's got a strong social conservative base of support.
Mm-hmm.
I think one question will be how he fares in the impeachment conversation. In other words, to what extent is he able to avoid tarnish from what happens over the next couple of months. I think that's the only wild card. Otherwise, I think he's going to be formidable.
It's a little Bush-Iran-Contra sort of in 1998 in regard.
Yeah. Okay. How does that feel?
Okay, so Vice President Pence. Next up, the holdovers from 2016. one of whom you're close to, Marco Rubio. I just went down the list of the leading delegate gainers in 2016, Lonnie. Ted Cruz.
Yeah.
Marco Rubio, John Kasich, Ben Carson, Rand Paul. I did not include Jeb Bush.
Yeah.
Who I think his time has come and gone.
Yeah.
So what do you think about those guys?
Yeah, I think a number of them will probably express interest. I think Ted Cruz probably will. I don't know what, you know, if any plans Rubio has. I think Rubio's positioned himself pretty well, actually, because in many ways, representing Florida, he's a bellwether for sort of swing state Republican. At times been supportive of the president, at times hasn't been. He's managed, I think, to maintain a pretty nice profile. I would say the same thing about Cruz. Mm-hmm. You know, Carson now, having been in government as Secretary of HUD, you know, he may decide he wants to do it again. Rand Paul, I think, represents a constituency, and so I think he probably runs. Someone like him or his ilk probably runs. I think you're right about Jeb Bush. I think in some ways it's too bad because he represents a kind of competent, technocratic Republican that I personally find very attractive, but obviously most Republicans don't find particularly attractive.
Right.
So I think a number of those guys run, you know. It'll be interesting to see how many of them actually pull the trigger, but I'd bet a number of them do. Kasich, to me, is a tough one because he's been so contrarian and he stepped out in so many ways.
Right.
There is a lane for him, though, don't get me wrong.
Right. You surprised he's not challenging Trump?
Well, I think, look, I think the marketplace for challenging the president is entirely – it's a true marketplace. If the president gets into trouble, and if it's serious trouble – and it looks like he might not make it for whatever reason, you're going to see a bunch of people all of a sudden express interest in running against him.
Right.
The fact that Kasich isn't running against him is more a function of what I think is probably good political sense than anything else.
Mm-hmm. Let me paint a scenario for you, Lonnie. And this is the scenario. If impeachment in 2019 and 20 plays out the same as it did in 1998 and 99, the House impeached Bill Clinton on 2 of 4 articles in December, about a week before Christmas, December 17th, I think. Merry Christmas, Mr. President. But they forwarded 2 articles. One was on perjury. The other one was obstruction of justice. Other two they set aside. I could easily give you 4 articles they could do on Trump. But let's say 2 advanced to the Senate. The Senate took up the trial, began the trial in the middle of January, and the vote was on February the 12th, Abraham Lincoln's birthday, ironically. If you look at the 2020 calendar, Lonnie, February 12th is the day after the New Hampshire primary. Now, in a very unlikely world, because first of all, you're not going to have to write down the names of 20 Republican senators who are going to convict a Republican president, hard to see right now. But what happens, Lonnie, in a universe where a president is convicted and ousted from office the day after the New Hampshire primary?
Well, especially since a lot of the primary rules on the Republican side have been altered to protect President Trump.
Yes.
You know, I don't know if there's a mechanism to go back and change them to create an open primary on the Republican side.
Right.
You know, the Democrats have a problem, too, because you got a number of leading Democrats who are sitting U.S. senators who will need to be in Washington for the trial.
This is a great point. This is really bad news if you're Elizabeth Warren, where you want to just put the pedal to the metal in December and January and be in Iowa. She doesn't.
You can't.
She doesn't be sitting on
You have to be physically present.
Right.
Warren, Booker, Harris. Klobuchar,
right?
You know, all these guys have to be present.
They already know how they're going
to
vote.
Sanders, you know how they're going to vote.
They're
but I mean,
vote, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, they've procedurally they've got to be there.
Right.
You know?
No, good point. Okay, back to our 2020-24 field. I know you're just loving this. So we've got Mike Pence. We've got some holdovers from 2016. Now here's where I need your help: the new faces crowd. I'm going to give you 3 of them and tell me what I'm missing here. Nikki Haley, Tom Cotton, Ben Sass. Who am I missing?
Well, I think Haley and Cotton are big ones. Sass, we'll have to see how his reelection campaign goes this year, or 2020 rather.
Right.
Again, I think he represents potentially a different lane of the party, and so in that sense, I think there's an intriguing thesis there. Nikki Haley, I think, is terrifically well positioned. I think she is one of the few people who managed to get into the administration, do her job well, get out. In a way that people view her positively, sort of regardless of what part of the spectrum, the Republican spectrum you're on, I think people view her positively. So I think she's fantastic. Tom Cotton, I've known for a long time, went to college together, actually roomed together one summer in Washington, D.C. So I've known him for a while and think the world of Tom as well. He is somebody who has a great resume, particularly on national security issues.
Right.
And has really built for himself a nice following. Whether he runs this time or not, I don't know. But he would be formidable if he chose to run as well.
Okay. Anybody else I'm missing? I didn't mention the governor of Texas. I didn't mention the most popular governor in America, who is Charlie Baker, the governor of Massachusetts.
I think there is a governor's lane that, mm-hmm. that probably will get filled, whether it's Doug Ducey of Arizona is a name I've heard. Mm-hmm. Matt Bevin of Kentucky has been thrown out there. He's been controversial in some ways, but certainly outspoken.
Right.
Charlie Baker is a governor, but fills a different part of the Republican Party here again. Larry Hogan of Maryland's another one who's done exceptionally well as governor. So for many years there was this really strong cadre of Republican governors, and there still is. It's just nobody talks about them because the energy is all on Trump these days, and the Congress.
It raises a great question. Come 2022, 2023, what Republicans are looking for. I read a great piece by Paul Maslin, who's a longtime Democrat pollster, and he worked for Howard Dean in the 2004 campaign. And he said, here was our problem all along. People think it was the scream on election night in Iowa. He said, no, the problem was this. We made a wager that Democratic primary voters wanted a governor from a small state who was really strong on health care, when in fact, when we did our polling, we discovered that actually what they wanted was a sitting senator who had military credentials, like John Kerry.
Yeah.
So this is kind of the question hovering over Republicans. What model are you looking for post-Donald Trump?
Yeah, and I think it's way too early to tell, in part because you get a couple of open questions. One is, what role will Trump play?
Yes. Okay.
Regardless of win, lose, impeached, whatever, he's going to play some role, whether it's from the White House in defining the Republican Party post-2020 or from the top floor of Trump Tower tweeting. He is going to play some role. So there's that. The second question is there more of an effort, if Trump loses in particular in 2020, to try and completely cut him out of the conversation?
Right.
And how painful, how possible is that? Will there be this moment of reckoning that some never-Trump Republicans and Democrats have talked about? So there's that question. And then, really, what does the political landscape look like? How are Republicans feeling post 2020? If Trump wins re-election and they hold on to the Senate, my guess is they feel pretty good. Mm-hmm. And then does that cement Trump's influence on the party in such a way that there will always be a candidate to carry the mantle of Trump? I think these questions, in a large part, will guide what voters are looking for.
Let me throw another lane of candidates at you, and that's, I don't have any names in particular, but the anti-establishment lane, which would be outsiders, entrepreneurs, media personalities. So Laura Ingraham, for example, a very strong conservative personality who's good at media.
Yeah.
And Donald Trump showed this can work. Or an entrepreneur who, like Trump, can just say, I'm a builder, I'm a creator, I can go drain the swamp.
Yeah, well, Kanye West.
Kanye
Yeah, right?
I thought he was running in 2020, but I guess...
Who knows? Who knows when he's running? But I... look, anything is possible in presidential politics. That's what Donald Trump taught us in 2016. Anything's possible. People who have independent followings, who are able to communicate directly via social media platforms, people who have an essence of an argument about what they're running. By the way, I think one of the things people miss in their analysis of why a lot of these Democrats running now are having trouble is because there's no thesis, there's no rationale for their candidacy.
Right.
They're sort of running because. And I imagine that one of the things that will bolster the effort of an entrepreneur type or media personality is they're probably going to have a case that they're making for why they're running.
Right.
Don't underestimate the power of a case. That can be really important in the success of a campaign.
Let me throw one final name at you. If we're looking for the fairest, Trumpiest of them all, Donald Trump Jr.
Sure. We didn't even talk about Ivanka or Jared, by the way.
No, but Donald Trump Jr. is the one who's actually out there flying around and going to small states across America giving stump speeches. I heard
Just
wrote a book. I heard he gives pretty good speeches. He's a fighter on social media like his pop.
Yeah.
But, it's a great question. How many juniors succeed in politics? Franklin Roosevelt Jr.
George W. Bush.
George W. Bush. Technically a junior, but namesake.
Yeah.
Could Donald Jr. pull off what Donald the original did?
Again, anything's possible. Anything's possible.
Anything possible. So your sense of the mood of Washington, just obsessed with impeachment right now, driven by impeachment 24/7.
Yeah, I think it's a pretty preoccupying thought for most people. Yet, I don't think it's something that a lot of people want to talk about, right? Yes. I think a lot of members of Congress would rather avoid the question. You got some members who are out there defending President Trump pretty vocally, Matt Gaetz and others who enjoy that, I think. They thrive on it. But, you know, you ask a lot of Republican members and they're just like, you know, it's just not something we'd rather be talking about right now. And frankly, you know, there's a lot of things going into this reelection campaign for President Trump. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of things that he can sell that he's done over the last few years, which are things that I think Americans would look at and say, yeah, I could see how that's improved my life, whether it's in the economy, getting tough on China, whatever. But those aren't the things in general that Republicans have to talk about or can talk about right now. I think that dissonance is going to be very frustrating.
I will say he put out a rather clever ad the other day. Mm. And the ad is essentially talking about accomplishments, talking about the economy, talking about judges. And the tagline is essentially, it takes a really difficult personality to get things done. And I think what they're laying out the case for is, look, he's not a kinder, gentler, soft man, but measure him by his results, not his personality.
And I think that's an important case they're going to have to make, because I do think that there is a relatively large number of voters who gave Trump a chance in 16, mm-hmm. who probably there's some things he's done that they really don't like personally.
Right.
They don't like his style, whatever. But if you look at the accomplishments of the administration – for those voters, it might be really hard for them to pull the lever for somebody else, given everything that Trump has done. Now, it might also be the case that they're exhausted of Trump, that they're just tired of the circus. And so in that sense, you know, maybe nothing the president pitches them is going to be enough. But that is, in my mind, the best case the president can make for reelection, which is, look at what I've done, look at why it matters to you, and do you want to jeopardize that? Do you want to change ships during a time when we have relative economic stability and, you know, relative stability around the world, notwithstanding, you know, complaints about the president's policy in Syria?
Okay. You give a lot of talks around the country and you spend time here at Stanford teaching the kiddos about public policy and democracy. What do you think, Lonnie, it says about where we are politically in this country right now? We went from the 1860s to the 1970s. You know, only one impeachment on those two bookends. We then went from the 1970s to the late 1990s, and now here we are 20 years later on yet another impeachment saga. So three impeachments within 45 years as opposed to two impeachments within 90 years. Is this, I hate to use this phrase, the new, but we keep hearing this and everything.
The new normal.
Is the new normal that we're going to start impeaching people every 20 years?
Gosh, I really hope not. I mean, it's a wrenching process to go through. You know, if you go back to the Federalist Papers, mm-hmm. There's a really prescient description of what impeachment does in one of the Federalist Papers, I believe it's number 65, mm-hmm. where the author talks about the way in which impeachment creates tremendous division in society. And whether you think it's impeachment that creates it or impeachment that amplifies it, it is certainly the case that this conversation we're having right now is hyper-polarized. It's hyper-weaponized, right? And people don't just talk about disagreements on policy. It's highly personal and highly character-based. Mm-hmm. And beyond that, you have a media and the rise of social media that permits rapid turnover in the news cycle, such that people are able to peddle their pet theory or their pet conspiracy idea, and it can just grow like wildfire. And that is the unique challenge of where we are right now. And I do fear that the environment's not changing anytime soon. The thing that has to change is the leadership. You know, leadership has to stand up and say, this kind of polarization, this kind of partisanship, it's not right. Partisanship is an inherent part of the American Republic. There's no question about that in my mind. But the kind of partisanship and tribalism we have now, this is not what the founders intended, and it's not what's healthy for our country.
Sounds like you're getting at a Mitt Romney speech in March of next year at the Kennedy School.
Yeah, well, you know, I if you look at everything Romney does in the Senate, he always wants to do it with support from the other side if he can. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a really admirable thing. And it's important because it builds bridges and it shows people that folks can still get together and do big things even if they don't agree on a lot of policy.
Final question, Lonnie, and I'm going to put you back in that awkward spot of being the Romney whisperer. So he has said he has an open mind when it comes to this process. As he is sitting, if it gets to the Senate, which it may very well, he's sitting as one of the 100 jurors. What do you think he's listening for?
It's a great question. I think he is listening for details about what transpired mm-hmm. on this much-discussed July 25th call between President Zelensky and President Trump. Mm-hmm. I think he's listening to hear about what else may have transpired behind the scenes between the U.S. and Ukraine that was directly related to the president's request to investigate Hunter Biden and Burisma and essentially ask for political favors. I think he's interested in hearing more about what, if anything, may have been omitted from the transcript that was released right. of the call. So there's all sorts of details that we just don't have a firm picture of. The other thing I think he'll be interested in hearing is, what are the holes in the Democrats' case? There surely are many holes in their case. We haven't heard as much about them because Republicans haven't had as much ability to respond in real time. Right. But what did the cross-examination of Bill Taylor look like? What did the cross-examination of the rest of the testimony that was been provided by career officials look like? I think all of those things are things that jurors in an impeachment trial need to be looking out for. And if they're smart, they'll all keep an open mind going into it.
Right. And ultimately, he has to decide what is an impeachable offense.
Right. He has to decide if it rises to the level of a high crime and misdemeanor. Remember, this is not a legal proceeding. I've said this many times.
Political proceeding.
It's a political proceeding. Right. And it's a judgment call. And exercising judgment requires some base of information. And that's what these trials and this whole proceeding is intended to provide.
Very good. Lonnie Chen enjoyed the conversation.
Thanks, Bill.
You've been listening to Area 45, a Hoover Institution podcast on the policy avenues available to the 45th President of the United States. And in this podcast, the complicated relationship between Republicans, the Republican president, and one Republican senator who twice sought the presidency. If you've been enjoying Area 45, please don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe to us on iTunes. If you wouldn't mind, please spread the word, get your friends to have a listen. By the way, we're not the only Hoover podcast in town. There's Econ Talk, The Classicist with the great Victor Davis Hanson, The Libertarian with the redoubtable Richard Epstein. We also convert fellow speeches. I bet Lonnie Chen is on our podcast feed that you can easily download. The Hoover Institution is online at www.hoover.org. While you're there, and I'm assigning you homework, sign up for Hoover's Daily Report, which delivers the best work of Dr. Lonnie Chen and his colleagues to your inbox every weekday. The Hoover Institution has Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter feeds. Our Twitter handle is @HooverInst. That's @HooverInst. Lonnie Chen is on Twitter. His Twitter handle is @LonnieChen. You spell that LanHeeChen. In 30 seconds, Lonnie, you're doing a new podcast. Tell me about it.
Well, I've had this podcast called Crossing Lines. It's been sort of designed at interviewing folks in the policy, political media environment and commentary from me. We're going to change course a little bit and talk specifically about the campaign over the next year. And we're going to take discrete events that happened during the campaign, and we're going to break it down with campaign experts, campaign insiders to say, what were they thinking? What really happened behind the scenes? So look for that coming in a couple weeks.
You gonna do this every day or every week?
No, I tend to play with. I would be exhausted. I'm exhausted as it is. I can't exhausted to do it every day. So no, we won't do it every day, but we'll do it a couple times a month.
Sure, look forward to it, Lonnie.
Thank you.
For the Hoover Institution, this is Bill Whalen. We'll be back soon with another installment of Area 45. Until then, take care. Thanks for listening.
For more podcasts from the Hoover Institution, please visit Hoover.org or Hoover's channels on iTunes, iTunes U, Stitcher, and SoundCloud. I'm Chris Dauer for the Hoover Institution. Thanks for listening.